From Istanbul, Turkey, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. It's been a week since protests broke out across Turkey, and Joshua Landis and I discuss where things stand in the normally peaceful and stable country.
This is an important marker. The people need to push back, and we need to confirm that this is a democratic system.
And later, Joshua Landis and I talk with journalist Kelly Niknejad. A week from today, Iranians head to the polls to elect a successor to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
It appears the only possible challenge the government may be worried about is what the Ahmadinejad faction will do. Will they go away quietly and gracefully, or do they have something up their sleeves?
Western journalism in an Islamic Republic with the founder and editor of the Tehran Bureau. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Well, Joshua Landis, here we are back in Istanbul after nearly 3 weeks journeying around the country. We've seen an awful lot. We're in the old city center near the Grand Bazaar, the Blue Mosque, the Hagia Sophia, but we're also not too far away from Taksim Square, where protests began last week. Boy, what can change, you know, in a week since we last spoke? Much has changed in Turkey in the sense that these protests broke out over a particular issue, over a park, actually, over an actual demolition of some trees and the building of a shopping center. And they grew and they spread, and now they've spread around the country. And we've seen several days of protests and a violence, kind of heavy-handed response from the police. What is behind all of this here in Turkey?
Well, you're absolutely right. That original issue, which was green space in the middle of the city that the prime minister and his buddies around him wanted to build a big mall and destroy this. So the environmentalists started it, but very quickly, political parties and the opposition parties joined in. But much more than that, lots of middle-class people, and particularly young students, began to crowd into the squares, and we saw these demonstrations pop up in almost every major city up and down the Mediterranean coast. There are a number of reasons pushing this. First of all is a growing sense of corruption around the political leadership of Erdogan, and he has been in power now since 2002. So there is this clique of developers, and the building boom in this country is phenomenal. You see cranes everywhere. So there is a sort of bubble, a construction bubble. But more than that, there's a sense that this democratic transition that Erdogan has taken the country through, attacking the military, attacking the judiciary, getting rid of the old Kemalist elite, is now headed to potentially a new authoritarianism. He's begun to act as a Ottoman sultan, rather high-handed. And people are worried. And so almost everybody we've spoken to on this trip has said this is an important marker. The people need to push back, and we need to confirm that this is a democratic system.
Well, many of the people that we've talked to since we've been here have been referring to Erdogan and his government as kind of these authoritarian neoliberals. Right, that they are capitalists. They're all about money and making money. And clearly, I mean, this is a country that's making money and spending money, and they're beautifying their country and they're building things, as you mentioned, but that they're doing so in kind of a very heavy-handed way from a very kind of top-down approach. And so are these people in the streets, even though it began because of an environmental issue, are these people in the streets now like really rejecting? Are these the people that are anti-Erdogan, you know, anti-authoritarianism? I mean, are they the ones that are the least privileged that are out there? Or is this a secular Islamist movement that we're seeing, a secularist versus Islamist movement? Or is it both?
It is both. But the secularists were pushed out. The Kemalists, who built the country, want...
And when you say Kemalists, those that were following kind of Ataturk's history and legacy.
Mustafa Kemal, named Ataturk, was a George Washington of this country, and he laid down six basic principles. And Westernization, secularism, the republic, and nationalism were at the heart of these principles. He repressed religion. This new religious party, which is very Islam-light, many people think, but people worry. You hear people here say, they're Khomeini. This is going to be like Iran. Give them an inch, they'll take a mile, and they'll have the women all dressed in hijabs and so forth.
And that's because they've done things like they've put limits on being able to consume alcohol. They've changed the national drink from an alcoholic beverage to a yogurt-based beverage. They've said you can't drink alcohol after 10 p.m. They've done a lot of conservative things that are worrying those that are secular in nature.
They have. And they've surrounded themselves with people from the center of the state who are Muslims. And they've gone back to the Ottoman history, which Ataturk had rejected. They're naming things after the sultans. They're looking east. They're getting involved in the Arab world, the Syria adventure. So people are worried that this government is taking Turkey away from Europe towards the Islamic Middle East. And that worries about half of Turks deeply. But the opposition here is divided. It's fragmented, and you can see it in the demonstrations. There's not one leader. And I think many middle-class people here are beginning to get tired of it. The merchants don't like it. It's going to scare away tourists. And this country is all about development and moving forward. They don't want too much disruption.
So lastly then, Joshua, I mean, some people have gone so far as to suggest this is a Turkish spring, like we saw, you know, in the Arab world, that the Arab spring is now being followed by this Turkish spring. Is it really going to go that far? I mean, we see, I think just in our time here, the protests flare up, but they're starting to kind of die down. I mean, the sense that you know, they are concerned about the future of Turkey economically and that this is not really the way forward.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is not anything to do with the Arab Spring. This is a hiccup on the road towards greater democracy, I think most people here believe. This is not an authoritarian government. It's not a dictatorship. It's been elected by a majority of the people twice in what are considered free elections.
But a small majority, right? I mean, he has a very small majority. Is that the main issue here?
50%. I mean,
but just barely.
A majority than most American presidents ever get. So, and this is a parliamentary system where you have lots of little parties. So for one party to get over 50% is unusual. It's not a two-party system like the United States. So this is a big centrist party. He's used religion. He has brought the Kurds in. He's been very smart, sort of like the Clinton or the Reagan, you know, revolutions in America, where he reached out and he's brought in a big middle class. And undoing that and attacking him is going to be very difficult for the opposition, which is fragmented. So people are a little resentful, but they don't know how to break apart that coalition that he has really skillfully knitted together.
Well, he'll have to continue to skillfully manage this. I mean, he's really kind of shrugged his shoulders a bit at the events of the last few days.
He said these guys are thugs, that this is the wrong thing. Now, his president, Gül, who's from his same party, has said, we've heard the message. This is a democracy. We want to listen to you. So they've a lot of contradictory statements. Erdogan has been the bad cop, saying we're going to crush this and I can bring out tons more people than these 100,000 demonstrators represent. And you've had the president who's taken the soft side. We hear you. We're going to make changes, so forth. So this is, it seems to be a vibrant democracy that's all about capitalism and growing, and they do not want political violence.
Well, with the millions of tourists that come here every year and the amount of money that they bring into this country, any kind of instability and unrest is certainly going to be a huge blow to them. So, well, thank you, Joshua Landis, for your insight. It's been very interesting to see the developments here in Turkey. What a wonderful country, but also one that's very interesting in terms of its political and economic development.
And this is an important moment, an important moment.
So next week we move on to another country. So off to away from Turkey and off to the Middle East. So thank you, Joshua Landis.
Great to be with you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewskgou. Next, Joshua Landis and I talk with Kelly Miknejad. She's an Iranian-born journalist who founded the independent news organization Tehran Bureau in 2008. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. In 2008, Kelly Miknejad signed up for a blog and started publishing news stories and features about her home country of Iran from her parents' living room in Boston. Tehran Bureau took off in 2009 when the re-election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad dominated international headlines. A week from today, Iranians will elect a successor to the controversial but term-limited leader. Kelly Miknejad, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, that's very interesting work in Tehran with the creation of the Tehran Bureau in 2008. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Tehran Bureau does and what prompted you to begin this movement, basically, an internet movement, an effort to try and enhance information in Tehran?
You know, I think the question of access is always an important one in journalism. And in Iran, it's vital because if you want to return to Iran, you need to maintain your access by making sure you stay within an accepted realm of reporting. If you're Iranian, you're being monitored 24 hours a day. Your family is a virtual hostage. So you're not going to report what's really going on in the country. And the fewer people that are there reporting from Iran, the more lopsided or more distorted view of what's going on in that country becomes. So the internet created a new space where you didn't have to be in Iran to be in touch with people. So I think a lot of people think that social media replaces on-the-ground reporting, which is not the case at all in my perspective. It's a way of putting yourself in touch with more people who are on the ground, so you're not just dependent on one minder who is then reporting back to the Ministry of Cultural Islamic Guidance. You're in touch with people who are in different neighborhoods, who have different backgrounds, who are in different cities, and you get to see what part of what they say overlaps, what doesn't, why doesn't it overlap, is it because this is wrong or is it because the reality is different in this neighborhood or in this city. So it just seemed like the common sense thing to do, and called the Tehran Bureau because I think it went back to a class I had in journalism school at Columbia. David Remnick, the New Yorker, was a guest, and I asked him about his magazine's Iran coverage, and he dismissed my criticism by saying, no one has a bureau in Tehran. And I go, well, what about the AP? He goes, that's not a real full-fledged bureau. And it lodged in my mind that, okay, the Iranian government doesn't want to let anyone have a real bureau, but the internet has created a space where you can do things in the virtual world that you can't do the real world. So that's kind of where it came in. That's where the idea and the name came from. But basically, it was because I was very frustrated by both the Iranian government that doesn't let anything but propaganda get through, and also by the Western media that has a very simplistic view of Iran. And part of that is because, you know, in American journalism, you're not supposed to cover Iran or anything if you're Iranian, because somehow you will not have the required objectivity, distance to be able to do it without having an agenda. So I think having Tehran Bureau was a way of kind of fighting my way against the stream in American journalism, and of course trying to get through, cut through the red tapes that the Iranian government had set up in order to be able to control what kind of reporting gets done from Iran.
So this online news magazine, basically, that you created it the year before things started heating up, if you will, in Iran, the year before Ahmadinejad's controversial reelection, the year before the attempted revolution in the streets of Tehran. Did you sense that this was coming, and that did this lead you to kind of creating this news outlet? Or was this just coincidental?
No, I knew that it would be an important election. I had no idea what happened would happen. I don't think anybody did. But I did want to be set up to be able to cover it because I thought it would be important. Important how, I didn't know, but I knew it was important. I knew how I had to do it. I was trying to do Tehran Bureau long before 2008. It's just that 2008 is when we had the presidential election in November. Obama was president. That, I think, opened the way for many changes in the world, and I had a feeling that this would also affect the Iranian presidential election in June. So it actually came down to, I think I didn't do it sooner because I couldn't find the money, and then when it was just the election was a few months away, I thought, okay, I have to do it now, even though I don't have the funding to do it. And that's why Tehran Bureau was started as a blog, not to blog, but to use free software to publish stories. And it's interesting because it wasn't because of the election. It was because when I was a journalism student, I felt the stories that I was doing in New York were more nuanced and gave a more accurate picture of what was going on in Iran than what was being reported in the New York Times. And of course, when you start digging up and trying to understand why the view is so limited, it's because you do want to maintain your access. It is because you're not just covering Iran. You're covering whatever is the big, sexy story of the day. And I think that really hurts journalism when you try to be all over whatever you think the story of the day is. And I think there's also this movement in journalism to specialize and to get to know what you're reporting, which is, again, something we've always had a knee-jerk reaction against. Like, okay, if you've been in a country too long, we take you because we don't want you to become a native, or we don't want you – we want someone with fresh eyes who can see things will be interesting. So it's a way of doing journalism by taking all that into account that, okay, we can be better journalists if we do actually use people who speak the language, who know the culture, who can read the Iranian press. You do want people who have fresh eyes, who can give you a perspective that someone who lives there can't give you. You do want a scholar who has spent, you know, all these hours working on – you want all of that. And how to turn all, you know, the evidence that you have into journalism is what Tehran Bureau is about, and something that you can't really do. There's no room for in a regular newspaper.
Our guest is Kelly Nicknejad, an Iranian-American journalist and the founder and editor-in-chief of the website Tehran Bureau. We'll talk more right after a break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Gralat, the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. We're talking with Kelly Nicknejad, who started the website Tehran Bureau in 2008 to fill the void of journalism about her home country. Just before the break, she described how specialization can lead to better journalists, writers who speak the language and know the culture of the countries they cover. Joining me in this conversation is Joshua Landis.
Let me ask you, how have you been able to maintain doing what you consider serious journalism, even though clearly the money, public attention wants something lighter? And how do you manage to stay on track?
You know, I think we underestimate the public. I know you've heard this before, but we do underestimate the public. When you give them something that's good and interesting and they can trust, I think they're interested in it. And I think mostly I would say thanks to Frontline. They've been, you know, funding me for almost 4 years. They've made it possible for me to continue. They made it possible for me to travel, to meet our reporters, our bloggers. Now we're at The Guardian, and that's given us a platform to reach out to even more people. More people have heard of The Guardian. It's more of an international audience.
Can I – you mentioned in the beginning that as an Iranian, very hard to cover Iran. The traditional way of covering the news is the New York Times or the Washington Post sends out some white boy that's Harvard educated to go and do these things that doesn't have deep knowledge. Maybe he gains that after his second or third year in the region, but then he's pulled out and he goes someplace else. What we're witnessing now, and I see it in the coverage of Syria, is a sea change difference. Mm-hmm. It's native people who are doing most of the reporting. Mm-hmm. Now in Syria, it's Iraqis, Lebanese. There's Rana Abu Zaid for Time magazine who's gotten into Raqqa. She's been embedded with Jabhat al-Nusra, this al-Qaeda force. Same with Ghayth Abdul Ahad, who's done a number of extraordinary things, an Iraqi guy. He's embedded with these fundamentalists because he speaks the language, he knows the mentality, he can get trusted. And they have opened up a new world of journalism. Now, they're not getting picked up by the major papers, though. I don't know what their salaries are, but I'm sure they're pretty small. And we seem to be in this weird new territory where journalism is depending on stringers and people from – and sometimes you get extraordinary talent, but a lot of the times you just get sort of generic stories because people are filing for $500 a story or $200 a story, and they're just trying to string as many stories as they can together in order to, you know, keep afloat. And so you get some – the general journalism is of a very low quality, but you get these stars that jump out that couldn't have existed before almost.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I remember once when I was being interviewed for a – journalism job that was going to be Iran related, and they asked me, they go, well, you're Iranian and this film is going to be about Iran, is that going to be a problem? I go, who covers Washington, D.C.? Iranians? No, Americans. Somehow we think that Americans have the distance they can cover their own, you know, government objectively. But then if you want to cover something like Iran, then you can't. When we send a sports writer, a journalist to cover a game, they know the game, they know the players, they know the history of it. We would never send someone who doesn't know baseball or football to cover it. But we do that when it comes to international politics. And we do that at the very highest level, which is then something that is being emulated by the smaller papers and the agencies that don't have that kind of knowledge, or even that one person who's in Iran or who has. So it's, and I'm using Iran as an example generally, like you said, it's a very new, both exciting and, you know, strange place for journalism to be. And, you know, I think journalists are like what people used to say about lawyers. They're very conservative and they're very, like, they're not open to change. And we make the mistake of thinking that there's two extremes. One is to do journalism exactly the way that it was being done, you know, 50 years ago. And if not, then we open ourselves up to any information that is coming through Twitter, Facebook, any social media, without vetting it, without knowing who the person is, you know, with the anonymity. There's room for really great journalism in between, and I don't know why that's not seen, and it's not, no one takes advantage of it. That's what I'm trying to do. I think this is what you're trying to do. And for some reason, it's hard to get people to understand that. A lot of people are investing in tools to generate information. What information are you generating? What are you going to tweet or put on Facebook or whatever gadget it is that needs fueling without the journalism? I don't understand how that's supposed to happen, how you can put so much investment in this, in the gadgets, in the bells and whistles, and not in the actual journalism. So, yeah, we are in a very strange place. And I think maybe it's because it's people who don't understand journalism, who don't do journalism, who are in charge of deciding who gets $1 million, who gets, you know, $10,000, who gets $100,000. And I don't think it's being well spent at all.
So in the short time we have left, can I ask you, in Iran, we're expecting presidential elections soon. Ahmadinejad will be leaving office. Is there any thought about what you're going to be covering here pretty soon in Iran?
They have had 4 years to make sure that what happened in 2009 doesn't happen again. So I think everyone believes that it's going to be, you know, very well choreographed, under control. The only challenge at this moment, I mean, of course, anything can change at any moment, and most of what happens very close to the actual polling date. But at this point, it appears the only possible challenge the government may be worried about is what the Ahmadinejad faction will do. Will they go away quietly and gracefully, or do they have something up their sleeve? So that's the conventional wisdom right now, that it's going to be uneventful. The potential candidates who can get through, can get vetted through the Guardian Council, are not anybody can get very excited about. So what is the Supreme Leader going to do to see to it that people do show up, enough people show up so that they can project it back to the world that we have a, you know, thriving Islamic democracy? So I don't know. I think that they're probably not worried about the Green Movement at this point. And of course, again, things change all the time, and they change very quickly, and they can change in unexpected ways. But at this point in time, given the landscape, that's how things look.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kelly Niknejad, for being with us today on Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Iranian-American journalist Kelly Niknejad. You can see pictures and videos from our earlier discussion about Turkey's protests by visiting the Worldviews page of our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces and edits the show. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview. And Hallie Arias is our digital content intern. Next week, we'll report from Tel Aviv, Israel. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzak Ralat.